Hello and welcome to the second episode of the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
So just to introduce ourselves again, for those who missed our first episode, my name is Mike Ryder. I'm a third year PhD student in the English department looking at philosophy, biopolitics and sovereignty.
And I'm Josh Hughes. I'm a final year PhD student. From the law school, and I'm looking at the international law issues surrounding killer robots and accountability for them.
Great. So in this second episode, Josh, I thought we'd carry on from what we were speaking about last time, because we were talking about autonomous cars. And I think there's a lot of ethical problems around autonomous cars that we've seen in the news recently. So, yeah. I mean, what's your lowdown on this?
Well, in terms of kind of the ethics, I think the most pressing kind of issue, I mean, obviously there's issues around automation of vehicles and how that affects drivers, particularly people who are employed in driving, because driving is one of the most highly paid jobs that doesn't require higher education. So there's lots of drivers, particularly like long distance haulage drivers, who are going to be out of a job soon. So there's massive ethical implications there. But perhaps kind of the biggest kind of issue for most people is what's going to happen when an autonomous vehicle is faced with decisions about crashes and collisions, and what's going to happen when there's a situation where the car has to choose between saving its passengers and saving pedestrians, or not saving them, as the choice may be.
Yeah, and I mean, these decisions are they're not just fundamental to the problem at hand, but they're fundamental in the sense that they say a lot about where we are as a species, I'd think, because. Yeah. How we program these machines to interact with passengers and pedestrians says a lot about where we stand and how we rate life itself and the human.
Yeah, and I mean, there's obviously lots of issues around a social hierarchy that I think we'll probably sort of get into later on. And I think that discussion is going to be prompted by the Moral Machines game, which is a game online created by MIT. If you can play the game yourself, it's at www.moralmachine.mit.edu. And basically in that game, you play the role of a programmer, essentially, who's deciding in advance about whether to intervene with an autonomous vehicle, and whether that intervention and how that intervention should value human life. Should it value the passengers more than pedestrians? Should it value those of what it refers to as a higher social class or social value than other people? Should it favour old people over young people, or middle-aged people over babies, and that kind of thing? And there's lots of interesting things that we're going to sort of dig into, but it's all based around the trolley problem, which I think, Mike, you've got a lot of ideas about.
Yeah, so the trolley problem, for those of you who haven't heard of it, is it's a famous, I suppose you'd call it, philosophical essay regarding the choices made by humans, and then we can extrapolate to machines as well. So the idea is there's a trolley, or you can imagine it like a train on a track, and there's someone on the track. And the option is you can pull the lever to send the trolley onto another track and avoid the person, or you can not. Now, the problem then gets more complicated when you find that there are more people on the other track. So this then raises ethical questions around, well, murder and personal responsibility. So, for example, say Josh is stranded on the train track and the trolley is hurtling towards him. So, if I do nothing and let the train continue hurtling towards him and squash him, essentially, that poses a dilemma for me. So, because I've got the ability to pull the lever, and I don't, does that therefore leave me being responsible or not? Now, this then becomes more difficult when you imagine that on the other line, there's not just one person, but two people. So, if I choose to pull the lever and save Josh, who I happen to know, not only am I making a deliberate choice to save Josh's life, but I'm then also making a deliberate choice to kill two people on the other line. This then gets more complicated.
It gets very complicated, and there's many different kind of situations and scenarios, isn't there?
Yeah, so it gets even more complicated when you think about where the train might have come from, or where the trolley might have come from, and you're thinking, well, if I wasn't there, would it make a difference? So I'm no less or more responsible because Josh is still on the train track and the train is still going to hit him. So then you're putting me in this position where essentially I'm forced, well, not forced, but I kind of am forced to pull a lever to kill someone because I want to save your life.
Yeah.
But I will save your life because I know you and I don't know the people on the other track.
Yeah, this is one of the fascinating things that kind of comes up in the trolley problem and in the Moral Machines game. Is that we kind of, as we've already alluded to, we expose our internal social hierarchies of who we favour and who we don't. And not only is it fascinating, I guess it can be problematic in a way because you kind of see into your own, prejudices, frankly.
Well, it's not even our own. It's our human prejudices, I think.
Mm.
And it just gets, I mean, the more you think about it, the more... not only complicated it becomes, but the scarier it becomes because you realise the fundamental sort of values that you just take for granted, really.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess we can also kind of think back to shipwrecks. A good example is the Titanic, and the call that went out straight away was women and children first. So we can see that obviously society, or at least the ship's captain and the ship's crew, valued women and children over men. And over themselves, because as the famous kind of tale goes that the captain stayed behind and was drowned with the ship. And I think maybe there was some discrepancy over that. But anyway, we'll pretend that he stayed with the ship. And obviously there's also the famous story of the musicians who stayed and played music whilst the ship went down. And so it not only does kind of these discussions expose our own opinions of other people and how we classify them and hierarchicalise them? Is that a word?
Categorise.
Yeah. Categorise people, but also exposes how we think of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of another example that occurs to me. My friend went for an interview in London, and one of the sort of the interview questions, they gave him a scenario where he's in some situation, he's in like a sort of a room with sort of, I don't know, a dozen other people, and essentially they're all going to die. I mean, the building's burning down, and he's got to save one, but you can only choose to save one. So obviously, you can choose to save yourself, but then there's let me think. I think there's like a doctor, so you can choose to save a doctor. Seems reasonable. There's like a musician, I think maybe. There's a criminal. And there's a child, and I mean, there's a whole sort of range of different people. But things then get more complicated when you consider that there's also a pregnant woman among the group. So, just taking the pregnant woman example, if you were to save her, for example, you would essentially be saving two people. However, that second person, A, you don't know that that child will survive, for a start. Sorry, the door's just blown open as we're recording. not only will you not know the child will survive, you don't necessarily know what that child will turn into. So you can't necessarily be sure that saving a child in itself isn't necessarily a good thing. And this is where it gets even more complicated, because the interview question that was presented to my friend then suggested that, well, the criminal, who might be a murderer, could be a crime, any crime, it doesn't really matter what the crime is, the criminal has the cure to cancer. Now, as soon as you do that, you then get into a world of philosophical difficulty, because you're saying, well, you condemn the crime of whatever the crime happened to be, but do you then make a choice of saving that particular person so that you can save millions, potentially, or would you much rather save two individual lives there and then?
Yeah, I guess that's an absolute kind of morass of issues, isn't it? Because when it comes to the criminal, obviously, with crimes that are not, you don't go to prison for life. That's because, you know, society believes in the power of redemption.
And supposedly.
Supposedly, yeah.
Sorry, that was controversial unless for our second episode.
Unless you're, a Facebook commenter on a local news criminal. But also when it comes to the pregnant lady, we could think of it as saving two people, but that becomes the opinion that a baby is a person or an unborn child is a person obviously becomes problematic when we think about abortion.
Yeah.
And so it's, there's a morass of issues
there. Well, how far pregnant is she?
Exactly, and, that's another...
And don't forget the pregnancy in itself. I mean, though we're sort of used to our modern world of sort of most people surviving pregnancy, it is actually a dangerous process in itself. And she might not even survive even then. But then why would we value... Why do we choose then to value life? And this is where we're going to get a little bit controversial for some listeners. Why do you choose to value life in terms of quantity? And why not value it in terms of quality or contribution that one person makes? I mean... When we're going back to the trolley problem, I think I wrote a blog about this a while ago. We used the example of, well, you've got five immigrants on a track, and obviously they're immigrants, so therefore you kind of feel you're naturally not necessarily inclined to be positive towards them. And on the other track, you've got five nurses, as an example. So in that count, I mean, the decision for a lot of people might seem to be fairly straightforward. So you've got, say, you'll say, well, five nurses give more value than five immigrants. But then what happens if it turns out those immigrants are doctors? Because they could well be doctors. Or then what happens if they happen to be bin men? Why is that any more or less valuable than a nurse?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a tricky issue. And I think it links into something I was watching yesterday. For those who don't know, Darren Brown is kind of a magician and psychologist. He likes to play tricks on people, basically, but in ways that expose their innate goodness. So he's got a recent show called Sacrifice, where he takes an American guy who's not keen on immigrants, plays some basically tricks on him, and later on sets up a scenario where this American guy thinks he's taking a bullet for an illegal Mexican immigrant. And basically the point of the show was to say, one side of society, one side of politics says, look after your group at the expense of the downtrodden and the people who are disadvantaged was the word I'm looking for. So that's one side of kind of society and politics. And the other side says, no, look after the disadvantaged, even at the risk of destabilizing your society. So, I guess your opinion on different people obviously depends on where you are in the matrix of society, obviously that we've mentioned that the trolley problem kind of exposes these opinions and exposes these ideas, but in a more kind of quantified way, fortunately, the moral machines game that we've mentioned at the end of it spits out a bunch of data really about you and what you think. So what the moral machines game is, it's two different scenarios, both featuring the same situation. So you have an autonomous vehicle, which can either crashes the car and kills the passengers, or you intervene and kill the pedestrians. And there's all sorts of different ways of doing it and different ways of formatting the scenarios. But essentially, it comes down to, like the trolley problem, who do you value and why? And there's all the different sorts of people. So there's old people, young people, fit people, fat people, women, men, doctors, children, criminals, homeless people, and animals as well.
Does it include race by any chance?
No, it doesn't. Everyone is a strange kind of orangey terracotta colour.
That's interesting. Maybe because they didn't want to tread on that moral ground, maybe.
Probably, yeah. I mean, that would obviously add a difficult...
Or sexuality, even. That's another one you could have...
Yeah.
Not that you can really see that.
No.
I mean, obviously, they can't represent that on a small, simple game, but it's just another interesting one.
Yeah.
Or religious views.
Yeah. So, obviously, I guess that again... links into the fact that there are innate things that we can't tell about other people, and so we just assume. But basically, this game gives you kind of several 13 different scenarios, and at the end of it, you get told whether you favour saving single people or groups of people, whether you favour saving the passengers, whether you favour intervening, whether you favour upholding the law, because in some of the scenarios, the pedestrians are crossing the road on a red light, or like a stoplight, when they shouldn't be there. There's also, so you can think about whether you prefer rules, basically, or whether what you care about, rule breakers. what you think about rule breakers, I should say. You can also decide, see whether you favour one gender or the other, whether you favour humans over animals, whether you favour fit people or fat people, and they link with doctors and criminals to say whether you value, whether you favour those of a higher social value as they define it. So it's the trolley problem, the moral machine is exposal of these kind of ideas. It's not really until the end and when you're confronted with this data about what you think and what you've decided that actually it kind of makes you take a step back and think about yourself. And I ran this game with some of my students in a seminar, and a lot of them were quite shocked to find out what they really think about the world and about other people. So I recommend that listeners kind of have a go themselves.
Yeah, no, it really is a good game, actually. Yeah, yeah. It's quite eye opening, I think.
Yeah,
absolutely. Even though we are priming you now because you know that you're going to get some results from it.
Yeah, we've kind of spoiled the game, I guess, in a way. But yeah, definitely give it a go. It's that, for those who've forgotten, it's moralmachine.mit.edu.
Yeah, so what was interesting about this, because we were thinking about what you could take from this game, and obviously it reveals something about how we view decision-making when it comes to autonomy. But then we also then have to think, well, what does this mean for programmers when people are actually putting down the codes into these cars, into these sort of systems that are designed for public transportation? How does that influence people, and how are people influenced by their subtle biases that maybe they don't even expect?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few kind of articles that have come out recently about AI systems being racist, basically, because they reflect the prejudices of their programmers. And so, again, what this game exposes is not only that we all have inherent biases, but that we should try and move away from these biases and be a bit more objective when we program systems that affect everybody.
But that becomes a sort of dangerous ground in itself, really, because if you're going to remove biases, then you just resort to what is essentially like a utilitarian perspective. So you're essentially saying two is better than one. So two lives are better than one. It doesn't matter who they are or what they are. You're just saying it doesn't matter about the quality of life. It just matters that it's life. So they could be two people on death row. They could be two people like in their 90s, or they could be two babies. That you're saying two lives is better than one. And I don't know about you, but I mean that if you take take that to its logical conclusion, that just seems absurd as well.
Yeah. So I mean, maybe I spoke a bit too early about removing biases completely. But obviously, we want certain biases to be removed about race and sexuality and all that kind of thing. But ultimately, I guess what it shows is that we've all got social hierarchies inside ourselves. And the AI programs will reflect that social hierarchy. So it's perhaps problematic when one disagrees with the program on how each other views a social hierarchy. And perhaps then it comes to kind of the only solution is to have multiple people involved and discuss what type of people
do and don't get
basically killed. Favoured by the machine.
Yeah, it's difficult. Right, so I'm going to make a prediction, right? So this is November 2018. We're at Lancaster University, sitting in the meeting room in County South. My prediction is that when these autonomous cars come out in a big scale, over time, with all the accidents, I predict that the cars will inevitably favour the passengers over the pedestrians.
Well, yeah, that's...
Statistics-wise, because I can't see any way that it's not going to work out as a 50-50 split. Take millions of crashes and millions of deaths. I can't see any way that the car wouldn't seek self-preservation, because you've got to imagine the car is a valuable asset, so it's probably worth something in itself. So when you take that into its consideration, and the fact that pedestrians are unknowns, pedestrians are completely unknowns. So I can't imagine a situation where passengers won't end up better off in the long term. And I think that could be potentially quite dangerous.
Yeah, because obviously if you're going to buy an autonomous vehicle, you're going to buy the one that protects you.
Yeah.
Which is obviously problematic, because by buying an autonomous vehicle that protects you and saves your life, you're enacting risk on the world, and you're putting that on the shoulders of pedestrians.
Yes, or other drivers.
Or other drivers, yeah.
So then you create an economy. You create an economy of survival based on who can afford the best car that's going to protect them the most.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Which seems mad if you think about it.
Yeah.
So the alternative then would be, what, to have the state impose a set single provider of autonomous vehicles upon everyone?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether... not necessarily maybe a single provider, but a group of approved providers might be one solution, but obviously for those of a libertarian flavour, that's pretty horrendous to think about that.
Well, yeah, it's just, yeah, it just becomes very, very difficult. I mean, and then obviously those cars can themselves have their own set of biases built into them, which we may or may not know about. But even then, you'd imagine that there's no way that they would just make all decisions completely objectively based on however many...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when we talk about social hierarchy and programming that in, it's obviously difficult to... How do you represent a criminal or a doctor to an autonomous vehicle when they're just dressed in the same clothes or similar clothes, or they look very similar, because that's perfectly possible. So we talk about social hierarchy and all these different favourings and things that come out of the Moral Machines game, but really this is a thought experiment and actually thinking about how that can translate into the AI system and how that can be comprehended by a machine adds another dimension. Another dimension to the discussion about, you know, do we actually have to go maybe right back to basics and look at numbers of people as the only way that a machine could really understand what's going on, comprehend what's going on, because it's obviously very difficult to convey your social value or how fit you are or you abide by rules into a machine. You know, that's difficult to program a concept.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, the only way that could possibly happen, you'd imagine, is when the state creates records on everyone and everyone's got their own chip built into the back of their neck or their arm. But that's
this
me
is
going
great,
into
a
my,
very dystopian
my dystopian sci-fi view of the world. But this leads to two questions. And one is the actual bias of the machine itself. So obviously these autonomous cars, they've got to have some sort of capacity for intelligent decision making.
Yeah.
So does that not then, by its very nature, imply there's got to be some sort of implicit bias towards self-preservation of the machine? So if the machine's given a choice, take the humans out of the equation, would the machine be more inclined to favour any choice that favours its own self-preservation?
Well, it would depend on its programming. Because, I mean, we've already kind of alluded to the fact that probably manufacturers would like to sell cars or vehicles that protect their customers, because that's how they're going to generate income in the future. But that's not the whole story. I mean, we've already mentioned about vehicles that might favour the greater number of people. So if you've got one passenger in the autonomous vehicle and there's three pedestrians, then it might decide to crash. And ultimately, well, not ultimately, but this is all just part of kind of the puzzle, really, that programmers of autonomous vehicles are going to have to solve one day. And
yeah, I mean, this is where I think the networking could come into handy here.
Yeah, so for those who've not listened to the last podcast, we talked about autonomous vehicles networking together in certain scenarios, such as cities, and being able to kind of cooperate and
combine their intelligences, yeah. Because I'm just thinking of a scenario here. So say I'm in one autonomous car, you're in another autonomous car. There's an accident up ahead, which we're going to be a part of. Now, if we were completely independent, your car would take its decision based on its parameters that it sees. My car would take decisions based on its parameters, the data that it's got available to it. But ultimately, that could lead to a worse outcome for everyone than if the two were cooperating. So you might swerve left, I might swerve right, and we might kill everyone.
Yeah, I see what you
mean. But that means we'll kill everyone in our own cars, actually, because we're on the side of the road. But anyway, see my point. But the point being that if we were cooperating together, that might produce a better outcome than if we were than the decisions made independently.
Yeah, because I mean, you could quite easily imagine a situation where kind of the lead car in a column of traffic sees that an accident's going to happen and indicates to all of the cars behind it to put the brakes on. But they would all put the brakes on simultaneously, so it's not like humans where the lead car in the column puts its brakes on and the second car has to react to the brake lights. They would all
put the brakes on at the same
simultaneously
time.
So actually there's no or very little chance of kind of a pile-up happening. So in that way, it's perhaps more moral. It's obviously more moral to have
a network system,
a network of cars, you know, like a hive mind type of thing that we've mentioned. But I guess you could say that perhaps it's a way of protecting people's human rights, their right to life. If there's quite a simple-ish way of protecting life, then.
But protecting whose life? And that brings us back to the main question.
Yeah. I guess it's yeah, whose life is obviously the question. And there's quite a strong strand of thinking that, as it links back to, as I was mentioning before, if you buy the car, then you're creating risk for pedestrians and other people. And so there's quite a strong strand of thinking that if you buy the car, you should take all that risk. And so the car should choose to crash and kill you, basically. Because by buying the car, obviously you're putting an autonomous vehicle on the road that might not actually be able to fully comprehend what's going on. So that creates a risk of damage or of harm. And so actually the risk of harm and damage should be on your shoulders because it's your car.
But here is the paradox, or the crux of the problem. By in so doing, that car is then taking a decision that's different to the one you would take if you were driving the car yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, yeah, that is the crux of kind of our discussion.
So ultimately, while I like to think that I would try and save whoever that was on the pavement, for example, subconsciously, even if not on a conscious level, even on a subconscious level, when you're making that split second decision to dodge out the way of that lorry, I'm not thinking about the person on the pavement.
Mm.
So in that scenario, the autonomous car is actually producing a result that's less good for me than if I was just driving of my own free will,
yeah,
as it were.
Yeah, I mean, and also what's happening is that the social hierarchy of the programmers is being enforced on you.
Mm.
And we see this kind of issue of kind of the Silicon Valley perspective being enforced on people. Kind of we quite often see sort of people on YouTube having perfectly respectful but perhaps controversial discussions, and their videos being demonetized or removed from YouTube.
Mm.
And other things that you know, I guess they're quite controversial. People like Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson and that kind of group of people who often talk about things in perhaps ways that you know are not polite, not, wouldn't happen in polite society, but are also controversial in some ways. And so what Silicon Valley tends to do is to, if it's even mildly controversial, is to just blot it out and pretend it's not there, it doesn't exist really, rather than actually thinking about it and saying, okay, it's controversial, but this is actually, this might be perfectly legitimate to say.
Yeah, we need to start having these discussions.
Yeah.
As a society, we don't think about these things. Mm. And we do leave our moral decision-making to people who aren't really necessarily even the best suited to be making moral decisions.
Yeah, so, I mean, applying this kind of Silicon Valley and YouTube demonetization and taking out a videos idea, to the autonomous cars, it would seem perhaps that they're either just going to say, no, we're not going to consider social hierarchy, which would lead us back to kind of the numbers game, or they implement a social hierarchy that they themselves have defined. And it would seem to be a quite a left-leaning kind of social hierarchy, that if you kind of take a broad kind of assumption about Silicon Valley, which to some people would be great, but to others it's not, obviously. And but to enforce it is, whether you think it's a good idea, or whether you think a left-leaning social hierarchy is a good idea or not, to enforce it creates different issues, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I know we're coming to the end of our podcast now, but just to leave with a final sort of question, where would that maybe we can answer in another podcast, actually, now I'm thinking about it. Where would that then leave you with relation to the law and the state? Because, yeah. I mean, that's not a state coming up with those decisions. That is essentially making Silicon Valley into lawmakers in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I maybe wouldn't quite say lawmakers, but rulemakers.
Rulemakers, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really problematic because we see kind of, or seen in recent years, you know, Apple was quite famous for having more money than the US Treasury.
Mm.
you know, Facebook is so powerful, it probably swung the, or swung, sorry, the, swung's not a word, is it? Swung the 2016 US election. It might have swung the Brexit vote. It might have, you know, the influence of people, I don't really want to use the word weaponize, but use technology in an unexpected and nefarious way. It creates massive impacts that I don't think anyone's really kind of thought about.
No, and essentially we're saying corporations are now more powerful than states.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people say this, but I think it depends how you think about power.
It does, and I think that might be a good place to end it.
Yeah.
End it, because this could go down a very big rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time. Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.